Hi there, everybody. Sophie Aldred here, aka Ace from Doctor Who, and you are listening to the Sirens of Audio podcast.
G'day, audiophiles. This is the Sirens of Audio, the show that explores the universe of Doctor Who in the audio medium. I'm Dwayne.
And I'm Philip. G'day, Dwayne. G'day, audiophiles.
I was up. You were down there.
Sorry. I'm down. It's been a bit of a down day.
Very good. On this episode, we are going to be sharing our recent chat with Karen Gledhill, which came about after the after we heard the sad news that Pamela Salem had passed away. We reached out to Karen and had a chat with her. So she had some nice things to say about Pamela, which we're going to include later, but we talked a lot about her time in Doctor Who and Big Finish. So that's coming a bit later, Philip. That'll be good.
It'll be great. She was very chatty and a lot of fun. We had a good yak with her for a long time, not recording.
Yeah, actually we did. Yeah, that was a good one. All right. There is one thing we need to do first. Do you know what that is before I lose my voice?
No. What is it doing?
All right. We have to jump down the rabbit hole. Let's go.
Okay.
All right. Just to get me in the mood for this episode, today I watched a couple of episodes of Remembrance of the Daleks, which obviously features Karen in her role in Doctor Who, her one and only role in Doctor Who. And I don't want to talk about Karen's part in that so much, but I want to get your perspective on the story itself. Why do you think it's such a classic? Number one, that's the first thing, so you can start thinking about that. But I want to know, I've been in situations with kids, stepkids, I've got older kids. I've showed each one of these kids the Seventh Doctor and Ace, and particularly Remembrance of the Daleks. And my younger kids have always gravitated to that more than anything else. They're absolutely glued to the Seventh Doctor and Ace and Remembrance of the Daleks. And I'm wondering if you have any reasons why that might be, that kids are so attracted to that particular pairing.
Yeah. Well, I certainly remember when it came out being exactly the same, because when that first episode starts, it doesn't start with the titles. It starts in space, of the Earth. I do wonder whether Russell T. Davis had that in mind when he started Rose and the Christmas Invasion and other shows where he starts in Earth and zooms in. It starts in a way like nothing else for Doctor Who. And as soon as the title started, we've had the titles before, but once the show starts, it feels like nothing you had before. It is a whole new break. So I think it had a success. I enjoyed the first season of Sylvester. It was a bit of fun, but this was nothing like that. It had a totally different feel. So the two things that were, a few things. The direction is just so fast-paced and so exciting. There's stunts, there's Daleks, there's soldiers being flying across junkyards. So it's got all those elements. I was a fan. I'm trying to think how old I would have been. It was in, what year was it? 25th anniversary. What year was it? 88 then?
Yes.
88. Yeah. So I would have been 19 or so. So it had enough nostalgia in it in terms of, I mean, not that I saw any William Hartnell or Patrick Troughton, but I knew about the start. I'd read the books. So it had all that nostalgia. So for me as an older fan, and I was sort of about to, I think I was getting ready to drift off Doctor Who. I mean, it was put on a stupid, in Australia, it was put on a stupid time. It was part of the afternoon show.
It was 5:30, wasn't it?
5:30, afternoon show. The time actually varied every day. It wasn't consistent time. It depended on what else happened. It was hosted by someone, Valentine, who hated the show. and made no bones about the fact he hated the show. So I was almost at the point, and they showed the first season and Remembrance, and then stopped. And so I think I was probably always at the point of 19, going to university, that maybe the show I had outgrown the show. And the Remembrance came on and it had all these subtexts of racism, Ultimate Solutions. It was just mind-bogglingly good. It worked for kids because of action and color and movement. It worked for older people in terms of the fans, which was nostalgia. It worked for older people in terms of themes. It just had everything. It had the whole package. And, you know, Sylvester and Sophie just gelled together so well. They were just so natural. It was just a breath of fresh air. And the stunts, the school blowing up, the glass shattering, the everything was just so good. And the music was good. Now it's a bit too electronic. But at the time, the music drove the action. It had some quiet bits. It is probably one of those few shows where everything works. And it's no wonder it's always the top 10 for Doctor Who fans, because it really truly deserves to be there. So what about you? You answer your question. Why do you think it works?
I think I was similar to you. I was probably feeling, I would have been around 15 at the time that we saw the first season of Sylvester, and I was wondering where it was going. I liked bits of it at the time, but I thought it was just, it was going in a very funny direction to me. Now I look back on that season, and I really love watching season 24 now. But the fact that they showed Remembrance straight after Dragonfire, I think that's what saved it for me and had me just gagging for the rest of the season. The following year. So, it was the start of a really good couple of years for Doctor Who, and it's such a shame that it didn't continue after that, because I just think from then on it just kept getting better and better right through to the end. I'm not a huge fan of the Daleks, so the Daleks aren't a huge draw for me, but all those other elements, there was lots of nostalgia. I was listening to Captain Gilmore today. Did you know in one of the early episodes, I think episode two, a couple of things I noticed in episode two that I hadn't noticed before, gone over my head, that Countermeasures is mentioned. Did you know
right.
that?
I
you listen
do
out for that. It's counter something measures, he calls it. Counter intuitive measures or something like that. It's some kind of act of parliament that he's referring to, I think, something along those lines, or some agency. But it is referenced there. The other thing that I liked about it at the time and now, and something new that I picked up today, although I think I've heard this fact before, but I think I just re-remembered it by hearing it, Remembrance, was the TV announcement.
Yeah.
I could tell very clearly that was John Leeson doing that this time. Did you know that?
No, I don't think I did know that. Okay.
I haven't looked at the credits, and if I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm positive it's John Leeson. Absolutely. 99%. You're going to look it up, aren't you?
I am going to look it up. Keep talking.
But one of the things my 8-year-old daughter kept saying to me throughout the episode one, got to the finish, she's saying, who's that girl that's following the Doctor? And I said, that's Ace. And she said, no, who's that other girl, that creepy schoolgirl that's following her around? She keeps wanting to know. And there's elements there that are hooking the kids in. It really tapped into that, I don't quite know how to describe it, but every time I've observed it, it really hooks into the kids' imagination, and they love the combination of all these elements. Kids love Daleks anyway. But the Doctor, Ace, creepy little girl, all those other elements. It's really interesting watching my kids watch this. I'm enjoying that part of it too.
Yeah, it's a great draw, isn't it? And you were right. It was John Leeson.
Yep, I thought it was. I'd never picked up on that before.
No, so the voice is there. Roy Skelton, as always. Royce Mills and Brian Miller, Elizabeth Slater's husband, and John Leeson.
Yes. Well, I could tell the Dalek that was chasing Ace through the school, that was most definitely Brian Miller. He's got a very distinctive voice.
Yeah.
What was the other one? Royce Mills.
Royce Mills.
Yeah. Yeah, he did a lot of the 80s ones, didn't he?
Or
all of the 80s ones, I think. Yeah. And, of course...
Quite a good acting career, actually.
And since we're talking or thinking a lot of Pamela Salem at the moment, she was the first person we see in the episode. So I thought that was nice too. I went, oh, that's the first person we see. I'd
With all
forgotten
her
that too,
hair.
very first scene. Yes. Yes. And once again, lovely performance from Pamela. So yeah, a great show. Looking forward to watching the rest of it with the kids tomorrow.
Excellent.
All right. Anything else you want to say about Remembrance, or have you said everything you want to say?
I'm happy to say with what I've said. It's yeah, I'm sure it'll come up again, no doubt, at some point. But yeah, it's just a show I love in every way. There's not a character I don't like in it. There's lovely reveals. I mean, I love the Emperor reveal in the fourth episode. It's in the end, it ends up being a bit too much. It's good as a good gap. It's a bit too much like the ending of Silver Nemesis two stories later. Similar conceit, but that's okay because they got there first. They did a great job of it.
Well, what it got me thinking about today was I've never got round to, I've got the audio of the Target novelization there. I've even got the Target novelization somewhere, but I don't think I've ever read it right through. And I know
Oh,
it's a
it's
little
a
bit more, I think it's a little bit more complex, a little bit deeper than the, I think it's been, from what I know about it's been done really well. So it's actually encouraged me to at least dig out the audio book and have a listen to that. And
it's a
experience it that
really,
way.
really great book. And there's a lovely scene in the first person with what's the destruction Dalek called? I forget the big powerful with the cannon.
It's the, oh, I can't
Imperial.
remember.
No, I've got it behind me. Anyhow, there's a whole section where it's all in first person inside that Dalek's brain, with him
Right.
narrating what's going on and hearing
Wow.
the first voice of a Dalek. It's pretty impressive. It's very well written.
Yeah, I think I'll have to get that, dig that out and have a listen. All right, with that said, let's jump on out of the rabbit hole. And to lead us into our chat with the lovely Karen Gledhill, let's throw in a trailer for the first season of Countermeasures from Big Finish.
5957092
Coming soon from
five
Big Finish
eight
Productions.
We all know what happened at Coal Hill.
I put forward the recommendation for a special counterinsurgency group.
Countermeasures.
It's been a bit quiet. Sir Toby's got us rather marking time.
Aha, my loyal team.
You help me to track down some aliens?
Gilmore, there's something behind that glass, breathing smoke.
Someone or something is trying to contact us from whatever lies behind that threshold.
Somebody stop it talking!
So it is alien.
Well, it looks that way.
That door started swinging on its own.
Who's up there?
Rachel, this is poltergeist activity.
Who are you?
This is your last warning.
It's in here with us right now.
Behind you, Sarge.
No!
Get out of my mind! Open fire!
Five, nine, five, seven, zero, nine, eight, two, five, eight, two, six, two, zero, five, two.
For Doctor Who's 25th anniversary, Sylvester McCoy returned for his second season, and the big hit of that year, and in fact one of the big hits of all time for classic Doctor Who, was Remembrance of the Daleks. One of the stars of that show is with us here today, and she would go on to those who do countermeasures, Karen Gledhill. Karen, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, so where are we speaking to you? Whereabouts in the world are you at the moment?
I am in Cornwall, in the southwest of England, and this is where I live in a very, very ancient farmhouse. It's mostly 17th century. There's a one wall which is 13th century, and seven. It's so it's mostly 17th and 18th century, and it's rambling. And we live on 20 acres of kind of mad land, a lot of which is just rewilded. We've got woodland and water, and yeah, this is where I now
What?
live. I haven't lived here forever.
That sounds amazing. And I believe you like a little bit of gardening.
Just a little bit. And we only cultivate about an acre here, but I do grow a lot of food, and we have an orchard and fruit cage as well. So, but we don't have animals. It is a farm, but we don't have animals. It's very steep. as a lot of Cornwall is. It's extremely steep, so it's very difficult to actually cultivate a lot of it. But yeah, it's wonderful. It's like having another life.
So where had you lived before?
London. I grew up in London.
So why the sea change or farm change?
Well, I'm married to a man called Matthew, and we've been married for 35 years, I think, now. We met when we were 22, and he was a doctor, psychiatrist, and worked in the National Health Service for all his working life. But after he started making murmurings about wanting to leave London when he retired, because he's a very outdoors person, very he likes doing things, and he's not really into galleries and theatre and the things that are good in London. And I said, that's fine. I don't mind moving out of London, but if we go, it has to be Cornwall, because I have a lot of connections with this county. My grandparents lived here, and so I spent a huge amount of my childhood down here. I have cousins and an aunt and uncle who's still living here. I love Cornwall, and Cornwall has a very unique identity amongst all the counties in the country. There's a lot of sea. Australians love it. In fact, a lot of people travel from Cornwall to Australia because they don't want to be in England anymore. But Australia is the closest they can get to Cornwall in terms of sort of outdoor life, beaches. So there's quite a lot of crossover. And the Australians come here to surf as well, because the surf is great. Not for me, but for people who like surfing.
You mentioned earlier that you were near Bodmin Moor, is that right?
Yes, yes.
So when I hear that name, I think of instantly, for some reason, the story Jamaica Inn.
Yes.
And I love that story, and I love the different versions that have been made of it for television.
Yes.
And I like Poldark as well. So,
yeah,
but I've never been
very
to
much. That's where we are.
Yeah, I've been to the UK, but I haven't been down there. So do those shows represent the area very well?
Absolutely. I mean, Jamaica Inn is not far from here. We're about 10 minutes from Jamaica Inn, 15 minutes maybe. I read it very recently, and it was very evocative of the land around here. I mean, Bodmin Moor is very mystical. There's a lot of evidence, increasing evidence, since Daphne du Maurier wrote that book, of there having been communities living on Bodmin Moor. There's a lot of Bronze Age ruins, I don't know what you call them, but and it's being discovered all the time that there were definitely lots and lots of communities living up there, probably only in the summer months because it gets a bit wet and cold here in the winter. But it's a bit of Cornwall that people don't know, because people tend to think of Cornwall as being just the coast. But it's a big county, and we live inland. We're about 20 minutes from the south coast here, so it's easy to get to the sea. But to find the sort of land that we wanted, we had to come inland, because the coastal land isn't great for growing things. And also it's windy down here, so you don't get trees. I mean, all the trees are like that on the coast. They're all sort of blown. Whereas here we've got a lot of woodland, a lot of trees. It's very special. It's very, very special living here. It's a huge privilege. And we've integrated gradually. It's a lot of what they call blow-ins in Cornwall. But because we're not a second homeowner, we actually live here. There's less hostility, I would say. And we belong to the local choir, and I do lots of. We've converted a barn here for. Originally, it was for me to do music, because that's mainly what I do now. But now it's a big barn, a bit big just for me on my own, and we use it for concerts. So we do about 6 or 7 concerts in the summer months here. Small, 40 people, 50 people. Folk music mostly, but some classical. And at this very minute, my cousin, who plays in a band called Archive, which is not particularly well known in this country, but is very well known in France and Spain. And he's an old rocker, you know, he's been doing this for 30 years. And he and his band are at this very minute writing their new album in my piggery. They're here for 2 weeks. We've got a holiday let as well, and they're staying there. So we have a whole village.
Just out of curiosity. What kind of music is it?
I knew you were going to ask that, and I can't explain it. It's music that people dance to, but it's not house music. You'll have to look it up, Archive. I did go to a gig recently, and I managed about an hour. It's not really my kind of music.
You managed.
Yes, managed. That was a gig in London that they did. I mean, they're just, they talked yesterday about how music in the early 80s sort of split into pop and other, and they are other.
Indie. Now, other is good. That's me. That's my kind of thing.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I mean, it's
I'll
not
definitely
really
look them up.
Yeah, archive. It's electronic quite a lot, but then they wanted to come here because he really likes my piano. And he came down recently and said, oh, I want to bring my band here. I want to bring, we're going to go and do this, you know, we're going to come and do. And then tonight, I think they're going to go to the local pub and just meet everybody, which is going to be really interesting. It's kind of the London rockers meet the Cornish farmers, you know. I don't know how that's going to go. I said, for goodness sake, don't tell them you're vegan. They hate vegans down here. It's kind of, they're really dependent on people eating meat and cheese and milk. So, kind of, so yeah. We have a very diverse life down here, and but I go to London a lot as well. I play the accordion. Well, I'm jumping guns. Tell me, ask me questions.
No, no. Can I say I play the piano accordion? Is it the accordion you play or the piano accordion? I do.
I play the piano. Yeah, I play the piano accordion.
So do I.
Oh, so, wow. Well, what have you got? What kind have you got?
I've got a titanium, it's Italian.
Oh, I.
So I did after eight. Did after eighth grade piano accordion.
Oh, so my goodness, well, you're a lot better than me in that case.
Well, I tried to get into our local conservatory of music school for high school, and yeah. They didn't count it as a musical instrument.
They so don't hear either, except at the academy, the Royal Academy. You can study accordion at the Royal Academy, and people do.
Right.
I don't play to your level, okay? I have a very nice vignone.
Oh, I don't play up there anymore. That was a long time ago.
Well, you probably still play better than I do. Because did you have a free bass then?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I don't have a free bass. I came at it from a different angle, which is that I'm a pianist and cellist mainly, and yeah. I played in orchestras for years and years and years. And when I was about 50, in fact, it was around about the time that we started doing countermeasures, I took up the accordion because I'd been in a play once that. Was accompanied by accordion and I loved it. And ever since then, I thought, when I've got time and the children are old enough, I'm going to learn the piano accordion. And I went in from a folk perspective and I learnt with folk people, but I have an orchestral instrument. It's not free bass, but I do have an orchestral instrument and I play in orchestras, but I also play folk. So,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So let's go back. So where were you born and raised? Now you've moved to the beautiful corner. Where did you start?
I was actually
Before you start, I was on mute.
Okay.
I just had a quick look at your brother's band. His genre is
my cousin.
Oh, your cousin, sorry.
Yeah.
Trip hop, electronica, progressive rock, Philip, that's me. And new prog, shoegaze.
Okay.
Yeah, so prog.
Okay.
If it's prog rock, that's me. I'm into it.
Okay, well you can have a look. His name is Darius Keeler.
Okay, cool.
He's the keyboard
check it out.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. You should do. They're really, really, really nice people, but they have
just awful music.
Well, no, it's not awful music. It's just it's not something that I'm particularly used to. So,
did you just say they haven't grown up?
Yeah,
you're talking to two Doctor Who fans here too. What do you?
Well,
think?
That's also true. Yes, I know. And actually, I'm fairly childish myself, so I'm not quite sure how that happened. But anyway, yeah. So. Right. You asked me where I grew up. I was born in Windsor in Berkshire because my grandparents at that point lived there, my mother's parents. And so I think in those days people sort of, it's not like now. I think there was a maternity hospital near them in Windsor. So we were, I don't know where we were living, where my mum, my mum was living in London. But anyway, I was born in Windsor. And then we lived in London, in North London, for all my childhood, moved around a bit, but always in the same sort of area in North London, Highgate, Muswell Hill, that sort of area.
Oh, yep, yep.
Went to school in Highgate Primary, which is just a little local school. Went to a girls' school for my secondary school called Camden School for Girls, which I share with Emma Thompson, amongst other people, and Tamsin Gregg, and a few others who've entered this profession. So I lived in London, yes, throughout my childhood, and was very lucky, really. There were lots of things going on. And my first encounter with my mother was an actress. My mother was a dancer. She was a ballet dancer. And then she obviously had to stop dancing when my brother was born. He's younger than me, so she's kind of wound that up. Then she became a sort of presenter, sort of modelly sort of person. And then she eventually became an actress, but not till I was about 16, I think. But I remember somebody coming to my school when I was about five, and she did acting with us, which really consisted of improvising movement and sort of dance and things to the Nutcracker Suite. I have vague memories of this. I was only about five or six, and I absolutely loved it. And I think from that point on, I just decided that that's what I was going to do. And anything to do with acting that ever happened at school, I did. We didn't, in those days, in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't really much drama. There was no drama, formal drama education in school. But if there was a play, I was in it, and really wanted to be part of what was going on. But music was much more structured, so music was what I did within the school setting that was acceptable. So I did music. I played the cello in orchestras for years and years. I also was very lucky. I had in London in the 70s, they had in a London education authority, and they offered free music education on Saturdays to people who were able. And so I had free for 7 years. I had free music education on Saturdays at a school in Pimlico.
Okay.
So music, I'd say I was much more sort of keyed into music and did acting when I could, but it was sort of slightly frowned upon. I did lots of commercials with my mum when I was little because she was doing commercials at that time. Did lots of those and loved it. But I just wanted to be an actor really,
So how
from
did
a
that happen?
very
How did you get interacting?
Well, I did the sensible thing first. So I was lucky because I found school relatively easy. I loved school. My home life was, I'm not going to talk about it because that's too complicated, but it wasn't great. My dad left when I was very young. I had a younger brother, wonderful grandparents, slightly complicated childhood. And my mother remarried when I was about 16, and then things sort of settled a little bit then. So I was, but school for me was absolutely safe, structured, predictable, and I had a fantastic group of friends. And my year group, given that we all started school 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago now, we have a WhatsApp group for my year, which has over 50 people on it from just my year at school. And that's how connected we were then and how connected we are now. And it's really quite remarkable. And we've accounted for most people. There's a few that we can't find, but it was a really, really remarkable time. And we were at a very progressive school, which was unusual. No uniform, very informal, no punishment, no rules. It was a great school, and still is a great school, actually. But it was in that particular period of time, it was amazing. So then I studied. A levels, I did, amongst other things, classics, and I decided that I wanted to go to university. There was no such thing, and I didn't want to go to drama school. I knew I didn't want to go to drama school, because I just didn't want to be only with other actors. And I had a choice really of applying to do English or classics, and I sort of thought, well, I'm going to read books for the rest of my life. And if I don't do more Latin and Greek now, I'm never going to do it. So I decided to apply to do classics, and I went to Cambridge. I was at Newnham College in Cambridge for 3 years, and although I was ostensibly studying classics, I actually did acting the entire time I was there. The music just went out the window, and I did about 25 productions in 3 years when I was there.
Okay.
So it was continuous, absolutely continuous. I did manage to get a degree as well. I was very industrious, and yeah, it was a pretty intense time. But so I did loads and loads of acting, and then when I left, I just thought, oh, so what happens now? I still didn't want to go to drama school. I just couldn't, just didn't want to be around other actors all the time and nobody else, not have that input. So I just started applying for jobs, and that was in the days when you needed an equity card to work. So the only way to get work was to apply for every theatre. You could only get equity card through theatre, not in television or film. So I just wrote to every theatre company, like everybody else, and every children's theatre company and everything I could think of. And they, each company had two equity cards to give out each year. So I just wrote until I got one. I got a job with a children's theatre company because of my music, ironically, all that time. So I ended up playing cello and clarinet, which I'd also kind of fiddled about with a bit, but and worked with that theatre company for 9 months, which gave me my full equity card, which meant that I could then work anywhere or doing anything. And then about 5 years later, they abolished the need to have an equity card to work. But it was great. It was good training. It was good training. If you can work with kids for 9 months, then you can pretty much do anything.
So after the children's theatre, where did you go to next?
This is really stretching it now. Okay. So I remember doing a fringe production of Macbeth with a crazy guy who I was playing Lady Macduff. And he was mad, and it was a very small space, and he had very big weapons. And so that was quite a scary experience all round. But some people came to see it who were, who I vaguely knew through the Actors' Centre, which was just emerging at that point in London as a training centre for professional actors. And I used to go there, and in fact, I worked there when I wasn't acting. I managed to get a sort of part-time job there, which I slid in and out of when I wasn't acting. And some people who I'd met there came to see me, and they had just started an actors cooperative. I don't know whether you have those in Australia, but it was a big movement in the early 80s. And it was a way of actors representing themselves, each other in a group, rather than having an agent. And this really appealed to me. Anyway, they came to see it and they said, would you like to join our co-op? And I met them, and yeah, so I joined the co-op, and I'm still with that co-op. So that was in 1984, right. Beginning of 1983, it must have been, end of 1983. I got my card in December 82. So that was that. And then after that, I just started doing odd bits of things. I did some kind of strange film in Wales for the Welsh Tourist Board, some little bits and pieces on commercials and things like that. And then I got my first repertory job at Colchester Rep, and I did two plays there. It was in 1984. And then I just carried on working in theatre for about 9 years, maybe, doing small scale, big scale, repertory, in and out, you know, whatever. It was great. Had a lovely time.
Remembrance of the Daleks was your first big TV?
Yeah, I did one before that, and I can't remember the name of it. It was directed by a guy called Bernard Rose, and Bernard also directed Paper House and Chicago Joe and the Showgirl, which I had very small parts in both of those. I was at primary school with Bernard, so that's how that worked out. He ended up in America directing some lot of scary movies, horror movies, but I can't remember which ones they were. Anyway, so I had done, and it was something on the telly. Oh, I can't remember what it was called. I've probably got it written down somewhere, that I did with him, but it was a tiny part. And Andrew, I met Andrew Morgan. I had met him at a workshop at the Actors' Centre, and I auditioned for him for something else. What else did he direct before Doctor Who? Can you remember? It was another sort of science fiction-y type thing. Gosh, my memory. I can't remember exactly what it was called. Anyway, I auditioned for that and I didn't get it. But then when Doctor Who, when Remembrance of the Daleks, when he was casting that, I didn't audition for that. He asked me to do it on the back of this previous audition that I had done. I was lucky. You know, I played... And that I was still working in theatre at that point as well. I was lucky because I kind of was suitable casting for Juve parts. And because of the equity card thing, there weren't so many of us competing for the roles. I mean, there were a number of people, but we all kind of knew each other. And there were a limited number of actors for the roles that were available. Whereas now there are something like 65,000 people on the spotlight books here, which is just ridiculous because there's probably only a couple of thousand jobs at any one time, if that. So I was lucky because I was suitable for Juve casting. So I played a lot of people, young girls who fell in love and cried and did that sort of thing quite a lot.
Can I just run some names by you to see what
Yes.
that show might have been? Let me
Yes.
have a look here. White Peak Farm, Knights of
No.
God, One by
Oh, Knights of
One.
God. Knights of God. Yeah, Knights of
There you
God was
go.
the one I, and I can't remember who played that role in the end, but she wasn't unlike me, I think. I can sort of vaguely remember, but I can't. She went out. Susanna, was it? It wasn't Susanna Hamilton, was it? I can't remember who it was, but it was somebody who I think was on my radar.
Wow, Patrick Troughton was in that show.
Was he? Well, there you go.
It's a Doctor
He
Who
was in every,
connection.
he was in everything.
He was my doctor. I mean, he was the one I remember as a child, as a small child.
So
Right.
Shirley Stelfox,
I don't know who
Claire
played the younger.
Parker, Claire
Oh,
Parker,
might have been Claire Parker, actually.
Tennille Evans. I'm just going through
Gosh, this
female
is a long
names.
time ago, isn't it? But
It
that's
is,
the
but
connection with
doesn't feel like
Andrew.
it though.
It feels like it to me. So
So
I was lucky.
you didn't need to audition, you were just handpicked for this role, which was a
Well,
very
yeah, but
major
on the back of,
role.
well, yeah, I, well, yes and no. I mean, it was just on the back of having auditioned for him before, and also having met him in the workshop and things. So that's sort of how things happen. You're much more likely to get cast. Well, I don't know how it works now, but knowing people is really what
About.
it's always about, always, always. And it just, we got on really well. Andrew and I got on really well. I haven't seen him for a while, although sometimes he does come to the conventions. It was just luck. It was just lucky. And it came
What was the whole
to
experience like? What was that experience like? Remember
Doctor
the
Who.
experience?
Oh, it was great. It was great. Just, I mean, it was one continuous laughter, really. Dursley was a little more serious than most people, but working with Simon, I mean, he's just very naughty, and he just makes you laugh all the time. And Sylvester, I mean, we were all oh, Sylvester also. I mean, Sylvester is insane, and he really, really, really didn't know what he was talking about. I mean, when you have it was quite complex, that story. The actual, I mean, Daleks always puzzled me a little bit anyway, and I am quite a serious person, quite an analytical person. So trying to work out combinations of time travel and Daleks and these things that,
Two factions of
and
Daleks and a revolution happening, and
all that stuff. I mean, I know that Remembrance is number seven. It was just recently voted number seven or number nine or something. Was it number nine
I think
in
it
the
was
top?
seven.
Was it seven in the whole like 800 stories that have been filmed for? So I'm amazed, but I think it's partly because of the going up the stairs thing, like the
Oh
Daleks
no, it's no that I mean that
having
was
their
great,
plan.
but it's such an amazing show in so many different ways.
Well, clearly, I'm sometimes I'm being unfamiliar with the whole sort of gamut of Doctor Who. I'm never entirely sure why. I think it's also because it picks up from an original story, doesn't it? One of the William Hartnell stories with the what's it in there.
It's the same setting as the first story was, because it's 25 years on. But I mean, a lot of it's just the cast, because the cast just look like they're having they work so well together. There's so much chemistry between everyone.
We really did. We really, and also because there's no kind of, apart from the Daleks, there's no kind of monsters in it. We're all real people. We're all sort of, I mean, even Jasmine, I mean, Jasmine, I don't think works as an actor anymore, but she comes occasionally to conventions as well. And you think she was absolutely brilliant as that child, but it's a lot of it's in there. I mean, she just did what she did, and the rest of it is all in the effects. And I'm also still friends with Terry. I mean, Terry's quite, he's getting on a little bit now as well. But I do remember being quite scared of all that gubbins that was all over his face as wherever he
Devils.
is. That one, Davros. But I don't know. We had a riot, and maybe that's what came through as well. We really, we really got on well. We really, really looked forward to going to work and couldn't believe it was work, really. I mean, just, it was bonkers. It was bonkers. And that mad day down on the South Bank when they, under the arches, when all the Daleks, and there's only four that ever move at any one time. You know, they were these little guys in these things. The Daleks, they were small, the people who had to go in the Dalek outfits. And then there were all these, they let off all these big noises and things, and they'd failed to inform the local services that this was going to happen, and these fire brigade and ambulances turned up and things. I mean, it was all during the time of bombings, you know, IRA bombings and things. So it was completely mad. The whole thing was completely mad. And those crazy clothes that they put me in, I hated those clothes. There were so many brown clothes. And they wouldn't let me wear a Newnham scarf. I was a bit pissed off about that. They made me wear the Girton scarf because I had to have gone to Girton. And I said, but I went to Newnham. Why can't I wear? No, the colours of the Girton scarf were better than the Newnham scarf. So I had to wear, betray my college and wear a Girton scarf. And that duffel coat, which has it's kind of haunted me ever since. The duffel coat, it seems to have had a fandom and life of its own. Somebody even gave me one at a convention not so long ago, because I said that I didn't have a duffel coat anymore, and they sent me one.
Did you have much to do with John Nathan Turner?
No. I don't even remember meeting him, although he must have come at some point, I think. Sorry, you were going to ask something as well.
Just out of curiosity, they didn't have big roles. I don't think they didn't have any scenes with you, but there was a couple of other really legendary Doctor Who actors in there too. There was Michael Sheard, and there was also Peter Halliday. Did you have much to do with those, even
Peter
during
Halliday,
read-throughs
no.
or anything like that?
Peter Halliday, I barely remember. Michael Sheard, yes, because I think we did work together at some point. There must have been days when it crossed over because of the location, the school location. When we were killing the Daleks with a baseball bat, I think
he had a much larger role than Peter, but Peter had sort of like a cameo. Yeah.
Yes. I didn't meet Peter, on the actual, I don't think we rehearsed together because we weren't in scenes together. As far as I remember, we weren't in scenes together.
No, you weren't.
But with Michael Sheard, there must've been some sort of crossover on filming days. Because we did all the, location. We did all the location stuff first, and then we did the studio stuff afterwards. I think that's right.
Do you have any memories of any clear memories of Michael? What he was like as a person?
Oh, very nice. I mean, he was. But I also had a. He was in something else, wasn't he? He was in. He'd been in another series on the television.
Grange Hill, was it?
Grange Hill.
Think, or was that later?
Yeah, I think it, no, that was before. And I think that Grange, I'm pretty sure it was before. So my associations of him were much more to do with that, I think. So I met them. I mean, it's Harry Fowler was the other one. I remember having sort of a lunch or, you know, lunch breaks with George Sewell and Harry Fowler, who were also quite big names at that time. But again, I don't think I had much crossover. All my filming was with Pamela, was with the six, really. That was nearly all our filming was together.
Did you feel at the time as much of a connection between Simon, Pamela, and you? And in terms of, you know, we know later what's going to happen with the three of you, but did you feel much at the time there was a particular connection?
Well, yes, in a funny way, I think there was. And I think I kept in touch with Simon through all those years. So I don't quite know how, that we were in touch, and he was also he's a member of a charity that I eventually became a trustee of, and so we were sort of but even before that I was also a member of it, and so we used to meet at the AGM and things like that. So we weren't like buddies, but we crossed over, and if he was in a play I'd go and see him, and you know, so there was some sort of crossover. But you see, that after Doctor Who, I had another year or so of working, and then I had my daughter in 1990, my first child. So everything sort of changed after that. So my life switched, and the second child I had in 96, and that's when things really changed. So for the first 6 years of having children, I carried on working, but after that, I just couldn't really. So my contact with people changed, and anyway, we all kept in touch. We were, yes, there was a chemistry. There's definitely a chemistry between me and Pamela. And I think if you've ever worked with Simon, there will always be a chemistry. He is just one of those people. I adore him. Absolutely adore him. I I think he's great. And the three of us work really, really well together. I mean, we're lucky with Hugh when he joined, because that...
Were you aware that at the time people were already talking about what a great spin-off series you guys would make?
No, I had no idea about it. And I just wish it hadn't been so long that we got so old before they did it, because there was no way we could have done it, got away with it on television. But because I was 28, I think, when we did Remembrance. Must have been. You couldn't really fake that. But I'd still love to do a spin-off, but I'm pretty much on my own now. I mean, Simon and Hugh are getting on a bit. And they also, Hugh never stops working. Simon pretty well never stops working. Pamela has left us. So it's me and Soph. We could do one, couldn't we?
You could. So you went on more theatre, more productions and things, but eventually you decided motherhood and family was going to be your priority?
Yeah. I mean, I carried on doing stuff. It had to be a priority because Matthew was working. There's no way he could take part-time work. It just, that was not, never going to happen. So I carried on doing a lot of things like a lot of role play work and just stuff that I could do that fitted into having kids. I was a very dedicated mother. I kind of got involved in lots of things. I was a school governor and, you know, just explored other areas of life. But I never stopped completely. I did Wallander. I did three episodes of Wallander when that was on. Tiny part, but lovely. That was about, 10 years ago, something like that. Between 10 and 12 years ago, something like that. 12 and 14 years ago.
That's with Kenneth?
Yes.
What's your impression of Kenneth?
Yeah.
I loved him. Yeah, he was very professional. All my scenes were with him and very professional, just, you know, again, it's with telly, by then television had changed somewhat and you didn't really get much rehearsal or anything like that. So you had to know what you were doing, do what you were told and not ask questions. And that's pretty much what it was like. You were cast in the role, play the role, enjoy yourself. I was flown out to Sweden 3 times, had a nice time, had very nice meals with people who are all dead now. People, David Warner and Dudley, Sutton. And, you know, I just had a lovely time. I had a very nice time. I did what I was told, behaved myself, and was grateful for the work and the opportunity. And, you know, maybe things will happen again as I get older. You know, there aren't, as I watch television and films and stuff, there aren't that many roles for women. There's not often when I'm watching things, it's not often that I think I could have done that. Sorry, my cat is meowing. No, go away. So I don't really know what I would be doing now if I was still working. I can't think I don't mind. I'm fine doing what I'm doing. But as I get older, maybe there will be roles. My mom is 89 and she still does the odd bit of work. So we'll just see. I'm not at all averse to going back to it, but it's just a question of where I would fit into it now. There's so many people out there.
So how did you get the call to come back to Big Finish and Can of Measures? How did that happen?
David rang me. And at home.
David Richardson?
Yeah. And he said, he explained who he was and would I be interested in an audio spin-off from Remembrance with Pamela and Simon? And I said, yes. So that was
no hesitation?
No, absolutely none. I mean, it sounded great. So, so that's what happened. And I think at the beginning we recorded the first 4 in Countermeasures 1 and Assassination Games, but I don't think we recorded Assassination Games first. I can't actually remember. I know it went out first, but I can't remember which way around we actually recorded them, but they're all happening around about the same time. And I loved it. I mean, you'll know all about that work because you'll have spoken to other people who've done it, but it's all changed now. But in those days at Moat Studios, you got really well fed. And the combination of Toby doing that and his sound stuff, David producing, Ken, who is the most brilliant director, and then the four of us and a huge range of people who come in as guests on our show. I mean, it was just, what is not to like? Seriously, it was great.
What makes Ken the most brilliant director? We love him too. I just like to hear
it
from
him. he's really astute. I think however they cast it, very good at casting all the roles. He's just really organized, so he's got exactly the rota for the day. So you don't know what you're doing, but he will he'll say, right, we're doing this. And he's got it all completely organized.
He's good at spreadsheets.
Oh, he's really good at spreadsheets. He's quite obsessive generally. I happen to like him enormously as a person, and I think we just completely hit it off. And he's very, very clear about what he wants. He's extremely kind, so he never criticizes. He just says, let's go again. And he'll say a bit of that. He's very patient because there was a lot of giggling. Because you know the way we do it is in booths, or you'll know all this, but I will explain it again, is that we're all in our own booths. We can't see each other. We can only hear each other. And people get very naughty when that happens. The other one who was very naughty was Adrian Lucas. He's actually also quite even more rude than Simon. And so you've got these earphones on, and I couldn't see anybody in my booth that I'm in, that I was always in. You can't see anybody else at all. So you're just relying on this information that's coming in through your ears all the time. And we're all very busy with guns and all sorts of things going on in our little booths, and jumping and hiding. And there's a lot of that going on. And he's just, so he's talking to you. And he's just really clear about what he wants. And if it's not right, I don't know. I just found him just so easy to work with. But he was the only one I've worked with at Big Finish, because he directed all of the countermeasure ones we did. Go on.
Sorry, he did write for you too, didn't he?
Well, he wrote my story. So in series three, what was it called? Forgotten Something or Other. That one. And he wrote that.
We forgot it.
What's it? Yeah, you know what I mean.
The Forgotten Village.
That's the one. And he wrote that, didn't he? As well as directed it.
He did. He did.
Yeah. So he wrote my story, which was great.
I was going to say, according to the website, you actually did the first two box sets before you did the Assassination Games.
Okay.
So you'd actually done 8 episodes before they brought in Sylvester and Sophie again.
I knew it wasn't in the right order. Yeah.
So you had the three of you who were already familiar with each other. What was it like dropping that fourth member in Hugh Ross into the group? How did that change the dynamic? Did he blend in just as easily as the rest of you?
Completely. It was as though he'd always been there. I mean, it took on a new life, because I don't think we'd been aware when we did Remembrance that we were countermeasures, or, you know, that there was such a thing as countermeasures. I don't think it was really put on our radar. We were scientists. Simon was a group captain person. There were Daleks, there was the Doctor, there was all this stuff going on. We didn't really know. I have to say, I still don't know what Sir Toby Kinsella does. He is completely unfathomable, that character. I've been listening, starting again listening, and it's completely unclear what his job is.
He's a civil servant.
I mean, is he I couldn't possibly comment. I mean, he does say that in one of them. I couldn't possibly comment.
He's like Mother in the Avengers.
Is that? I mean, he's just there.
Yeah.
And you can't tell whether he's good or bad. I know he's.
You're not supposed to know for a while. I mean, the first two box sets, the whole thing is, can we actually trust him? Because he played it so well, and just the way. I mean, I'd love to know how much it was in the script and how much it was him, because just the way he played lines could be read two ways. And you're all the time trying to think, can I trust this person or not? And yeah, it's just, He was a
well,
great
I think
character.
I was all the time, can I trust this person or not?
Yep.
I had no idea. And I know that Alison didn't like him very much. You know, that there was a, because she is, well, she's quite a mixture of things, isn't she? But she is portrayed as being a sort of 50s, a 60s sort of feminist, very smart, but kind of out there, kind of, and very different to him and has a very different outlook. And they quite often clash over. I mean, I can imagine if you had it in a current situation, she'd be very much the gender politics person and the person who is really got really critical if you misuse pronouns and all that sort of thing. That's where she would be now, in life as a young scientist.
Mm.
And I'm very conscious of the women of. Yeah, women's place in society and that sort of thing. But he blended in completely. I'd never met Hugh before. I think the others may have done. I mean, after all, he is one of our most successful actors in the sense that he never stops working, and he works in theatre as well as television, you know, and has done for many, many, many years. But I just hadn't come across him because I hadn't been working for quite a long time, I guess. And I, yeah. But we got on really well. We made it, you know, we all laughed. We laughed. The whole thing is just laughter, really. And they all laughed at with me. Do you know about them teasing me a lot? Has that come up in any of your conversations with anybody?
Well, no one would admit they'd be teasing you. What were they doing?
All the time. Ken, David, apart from Pamela, of course. Who would never have done that. But yeah, they were always just taking the mickey out of me. I don't know why. I think partly because I continued to be very industrious about understanding the stories and none of the others bothered. So they would always ask, well, obviously David and Ken and the writers knew what was going on. But yeah, they were always teasing me and just sort of taking the mickey out of me. I don't know why. I was younger, maybe. Even at 50, I was younger than most of the others, not than Ken and... David's about my age, I think. Ken is a bit younger. I don't know why. There was a culture of let's just take the mickey out of Karen. and it is quite well known here in when I go to conventions, people know about it. So I don't know what it was. I have a sense of humour and I'm personable, but I'm quite a serious person. I wanted to not understand the story and they always thought that was incredibly funny. And I was very, very committed to the work, incredibly committed to it and incredibly committed to making Alison, you know, after all, I was 50 in my 50s playing a 25-year-old. I had to work at that to... give her the energy that she needed. So I had to work.
After doing your two box sets, they decided to for the 50th anniversary, I think it was. Have I got the right 35?
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah, 50th anniversary, to bring Sylvester and Sophie in for a special story combining everyone.
Yeah.
So what was it like when Sophie and Sylvester appear?
No, well, that was great. I think by then, had I met up, I think I'd already done conventions by then, because I didn't do any until I started countermeasures, and then they started sort of coming in. I've been in touch with Sophie all the time. So seeing Sophie was not a new thing. We've just done Christmas cards and various exchanges throughout the years. And been to see each other and met each other's children and all that sort of thing. So seeing Sophie in a work context was different, but I had been in touch with her. I'd also seen Sylvester a couple of times, actually, but purely on other things. I think I sang in a concert at the Union Chapel that he came to before countermeasures had started. And I remember going up to him and saying, I don't know if you remember me, but blah, blah, blah. He said, of course I remember you. And kind of. So it wasn't like... it wasn't like we hadn't all seen each other at all during that time, and I'm sure the others had had some sort of contact as well. Working with them was fantastic. I mean, again, that story was completely incomprehensible. I have just listened to it again. Completely incomprehensible, except that the light, of course, becomes important in our story. Yes. And also, it's curiously apt kind of right now. All the conspiracy stuff that started up again during COVID and during lockdown. And there's a town not far from here in Devon, Torquay, which is known as the sort of hub of conspiracy theories in this country. And there's a magazine called something like The Light that is published there. And it's full of conspiracy theories about exactly these people who are aliens who are here running the world. And for some reason, Bill Gates is always involved in that as well. I'm not sure why he gets caught up in it. And the lizard people and the sort of... And when all that came up during COVID, I thought, this is like an episode of Countermeasures. It's kind of, it feels like we're living. In fact, when it first started and we were all locked down and things started, I remember we all linked up, all the Ken and David and Pamela. Well, I don't think Pamela was, I think she was already a bit off the radar by then, but Simon and Hugh, and we all kind of were sending emails to each other and sort of saying, this is like being in a real life. You know, where are countermeasures when you need them? You know, it was that kind of thing. It was, we needed us to come and sort this out and get to grips with it. You know, it's really...
We actually reviewed the episode a couple of months ago, part of the Doctor's, for the 60th anniversary. I think one of the things that struck us was it starts off very much as a countermeasures episode, the first two episodes, and the Doctor and Ace are hardly in it. And then slowly as the story progresses on, they get a larger and larger role.
Yes.
So it's just this beautiful handover of, you know, the two units, but then still working together.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really nice. I mean, it seemed to work absolutely fine. As a link between the television series and then the and countermeasures as an entity. I thought it worked really well. It was lovely working with them. It was really, really nice. Really nice.
Do you know what made the decision to move it to the '70s? Because they said Sutherland.
I think they sort of ran out of material, really, possibly for the '60s. I think the first ones were better myself. I felt more comfortable with that era. The '70s got, it was funny. It was much more Starsky and Hutch. It kind of got all the background was much more. It went from sort of Quatermass, which suited us very well. I think also they just wanted to explore a different background, a different set of political circumstances. And I think they'd just sort of possibly just run out of material that they felt they could explore for the '60s. I mean, they put us to sleep for a while, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. But we didn't know whether we'd be back at that point. We didn't know whether they were going to carry on, but they gave themselves a chance. I think they were waiting to see how the sales were and whether people were still interested. But I was glad they brought it back. It was very nice doing those other stories in the '70s. I haven't got to that yet in my listening. But I do remember the background, the music changing. Suddenly we were in clubs. We were in kind of sleazy hotels.
The whole sound design changes. Everything changes. It's very, very,
I was thinking more along the lines of, it was taking me back to shows like Department S and things like that, which is more early 70s, like Jason King, Peter Wingard.
Yes, yes, yes.
That kind of thing. So the longer hair. Quatermass is right for the '60s, but the longer hair and Department S kind of thing.
And a bit more political.
If you haven't seen Department S, you should check it out.
I haven't seen it. Yeah. But the there was more. Alison gets more political, and there were different. I suppose. I mean, the advantage of writing something with hindsight is that you know scientifically some of the things that have come to pass, and you can put them into those earlier shows with the audience kind of knowing, you know, thinking, oh yeah. And that whole idea of a computer taking up an entire room or an entire factory, you know, and now we've got them on these, you know, it's like, and I think I just think it changes. It gave the writers a different different opportunities, different writing opportunities. We were allowed to get a little bit older, a little bit wiser. My regret really for Alison was that they never allowed her a proper relationship that worked. I kept begging them.
She was always having trouble with the men, wasn't she?
The men, the men always.
What was the spy, wasn't it? Yeah.
They always turned out to be bad, you know, and you could, that Forgotten Village one with Jack, and you just think, oh, it's, you know, this could just work. Maybe this could just work. And he turns out to be bad as well. And you think, oh, for goodness sake, you know, has she just got really poor taste, or are they just being really mean to me? They used to tease me about that as well and say, oh, we've got your nice boyfriend for the next one. And I kind of think, oh, yeah, you know, how's he going to die? And they never came up with the goods. And I think that was a shame. Although they couldn't really settle her down, could they? I mean, what could you do? I just think it would have been nice if she'd had a nice relationship at one point with somebody who was kind to her. It was actually, that was very funny, because when we started doing countermeasures, I was, as I say, I must have, when did it start? When did we start doing it? 2012. 12. So I was 52 when we started. And the first person who came was Alistair McKenzie playing Julian. And he was the first of many young men who arrived in the green room. And, you know, you do, hello, hi, I'm Karen, I'm playing Alison. And you could see their faces going,
oh,
really? Really? And I said, do you know the history of this show? No, no, I'm just coming, I've got the script, just reading the thing. And I'd say, okay, so this is a spin-off from something we did 25 years ago, and we are playing the same people that we played then. And then they'd sort of understand. But these poor guys, I mean, thank goodness we were all in our own booths and just doing it vocally, so they didn't have to worry too much about it. But these poor guys were having to play these sort of flirty romantic scenes with somebody who was old enough to be their mother most of the time. You know, it was kind of like, but it was fine. It works, doesn't it?
Yeah. Brilliant.
It works, because it does, I'm basically quite childish. So I could still do it. I could still do it. Now I'm 63 now. I could still do it. If I had to, if I had to go back and play Alison, I would have no difficulty with that at all. But the chaps might find it even harder if they kept bringing in younger people. Soph does it too. I mean, Sophie's a couple of years younger than me. And, you know, she still does it.
Yeah, it's what actors do, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And we look older, but
don't sound broccoli, it's fine.
Yeah, and we're not older in our spirits, so we're not old people. Sophie and I are both women who have grown-up children and a grown-up life outside of Doctor Who and everything else related, but we're both quite rooted in a much younger self. I'm about 23. so both my children are now older than me. Which is fine.
So for Big Finish's 20th anniversary, they did 6 special stories.
Yeah.
Picking some of the best of everything to do in terms of celebrate Big Finish. And, of course, Countermeasures was one of those stories that they chose to do.
Yeah, which story was it?
That was the Split Infinitive by John Dorney.
Oh, yeah.
So set in the 70s. But then after that was so popular, you came back for 2 more releases, one with the Daleks, one with the Mavellans.
Yes.
Just do some big invasion stuff.
Yes.
And
there was a Hollow King. Where did that fit in?
The Hollow King was a bit earlier.
They release things in a different order to how they record things, so you never quite know when. That was a one-off as well, though.
That was a special one-off, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And like the killing of Sotobi, too.
I love that one.
Yeah.
Who killed Toby Kinsella? Yeah, that one.
It was a nice touch.
So the Mavellan one, that was those weird things with the silver.
Yes, that's right. Well done.
That was the Cyril Nuri, yeah. Well, we didn't think we were going to do any more. We'd been told that there wasn't any more after one of those. I can't remember.
Several times, I think.
Yeah. I think we were told after the first lot, the first 16, the first 4 big stories, big series, and then maybe not. And then we did, how many? We did 2 or 3 of the next.
Well, you did the Who Killed Toby Kinsella special, which was a one-off. Yeah. But then you did 2 series of, then you did 2 more box sets in the 70s.
Yes.
Followed by the Hollow King, then the special in the 20th anniversary. Well,
and then we were told that's it. And yeah. then we came back to do two more.
Mm.
And we weren't sure. I don't really know why they stopped. I think they probably partly stopped because of Pamela, eventually, because I think she just may not have been well enough. She was not well the last ones we did, although she wasn't saying much about it. She at that point definitely had Parkinson's, and I think it was probably getting harder for her to travel. I think possibly Hugh was always very busy. Sam, I think, might have had enough. He was doing a lot of the archers. I don't know whether you have that over there, but he's on the archers. And I was always willing to do anything. I always am. But I think also possibly it had run its course. And although when you meet the fans, they always say, we want more. And I say, well, you know, tell that to Big Finish. But they have new projects going all the time. And I think they just want to regenerate and keep things moving and keep having new stuff going on. Also, David has taken a backseat now as well. He's sort of semi-retired, David Richardson. So I suspect, you know, there were things come to an end, don't they? When you're, they just naturally do. It's a shame that they didn't tie it up, but I suppose they never really knew whether it was going to come to an end or not.
That's right.
So they didn't tie it up.
They like to leave their options open all the time. You never know. Something may come back again. They might do some more.
I mean, they can't now because there's no way they could do it
without Pamela.
Can you go away?
Well, they could definitely bring you back with Ace. There'd be potential there for that.
I mean, I think that would be great, but how they would do that, I mean, whether they can give Ace a life outside of time travel.
Well, they have. She's doing a Torchwood series.
She's in Torchwood. So.
Oh, she is in Torchwood, isn't she? Yes.
Yeah.
I will just say your memory of what you've done is astounding, that we speak to people all the time, and you obviously your desire to understand what was going on has actually meant you remembered more, because we regularly speak to someone and we don't talk about any stories because they can't remember anything they've done or what their characters have done.
I remember quite a lot of them. I remember the one with the red sort of spongy blobby stuff that cloned itself, because I was very fascinated by that. By the idea that
could be any Doctor Who related story.
Well, it could be, but in this instance, it wasn't, and it was one of our stories. I liked Countermeasures. I really liked the way that there was always possibly a scientific explanation, but also this alien element. But you were never, we were always struggling to find a real scientific explanation for what was going on, but could never quite do it because there was always some slightly alien element, like the red spongy stuff that cloned itself, the jelly, which they encapsulated in something. And I can't remember. I just remember that bit about it. So I really liked that thing of it that I took it very seriously. I do take my work very seriously. I don't just pitch up. I do try to understand what it is that we did. So I remember most of them. And I remember finding things out as well. There was one where it was the one that Celia Imrie was in. And there were people down on the underground sweeping all the fluff out from the rails and sort of working at nights in the underground. And that was actually a thing. I think it still is a thing, actually, that they go down and clean the underground every night. It had never occurred to me that there were people who did this, that there was this...
Okay, the people who went out every night.
Yeah, there's whole life of stuff. So I remember that episode as well, but I can't remember the names. And I remember the Forgotten Village because, partly because I was working with Tim Bentinck, who is in The Archers. In fact, Tim has done he's played three different roles in Countermeasures. But he is very much a character actor and does voices. So he was in Hollow Crown. He played my dad in Forgotten Village, which was very amusing because he's actually only about 2 years older than me in real life. And then he was in another one as well, but I can't remember which one.
Here's a trivia for you. We had Tim on the show and he was born about 50 kilometres from where I live in Tasmania. Oh, there you go.
Really?
Yep.
I didn't know that.
It's actually Tasmanian born.
Well, there you go. There you go. He's a nice man too.
Yes. Thank you so much for all the joy you've brought to so many fans and the way you've been able to continue to encourage and then, you know, make a park grow so well. And when you come to Australia to visit your brother soon, we look forward to seeing you in person.
Oh, I'd love, yeah. Oh, if I come to Australia, I will definitely get in touch, and maybe we should make that trip. We should do before we get too old, before we get another dog. We should come over and do it. That would be great. And thank you to the fans. For me, you know, this, the fans are completely, what would I mean, I just don't know where I'd be without them, to be honest. I love the fan base and I love meeting everybody, so.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions.
If I fail, I need someone to continue the fight.
If I die, avenge me. Is that what you're saying?
Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
For as much as it hath pleased Almighty God of his great mercy to take unto himself the soul of our dear brother Tobias here departed.
We weren't supposed to make contact until things changed.
Well, things have changed. Rather drastically.
The new countermeasures. Who killed Toby Kinsella?
Sir Tobias Kinsella, deceased, was the head of a top secret organization tasked with the safety and security of Great Britain.
Who are you three?
I'm Carol Hartigan.
Catherine Solomon.
Captain Philip Benson, how do you do?
All three died in the line of duty a few years ago.
That's not the case, sir.
Beg pardon?
I've seen these people at Kinsella's funeral. They're very much alive.
Please! Can we have some car? Please!
Who are you, Pip?
Right now, probably the only friends you've got.
I want you to find these three troublemakers, and whatever it is they're up to, I want it stopped. By any means necessary.
Oh, it's lovely to be back. I just wish it was under happier circumstances.
Big Finish. We love stories.
You're enjoying this, aren't you?
It beats the hell out of teaching.
There you go, Philip. There was a trailer for Who Killed Toby Kinsella, an excellent standalone countermeasure story if you want to get sort of the transition between the 60s and 70s. And great story, as always. All the countermeasure stories are fantastic. I think you'd agree, Philip.
Yeah,
and a lovely chat with Karen.
Isn't she just charming? Like, so delightful.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I had her. I mean, so, when Sophie was out, Sophie had told us how delightful Karen was, and she was dead right. She's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. So thank you very much, Karen, if you're listening to us now. We really appreciate that. All right. With all that said and done, let's go to a couple of recommendations. What have you been listening to, Philip? Hang on. Is it your turn?
We're going to start with me, are we? Okay, there you go.
It is your turn. Well, it is your turn.
Is my turn. Okay, I'm going to recommend a story that's only just come out recently. It's the new Master, but not the Master you're expecting. This is the Master with Eric Roberts. So it's called Master Planet of Doom. So it's a few stories with him and Chase Masterton as Vienna Salvatore. I'm not sure if you've been listening to any of those stories. They've actually been, this is the third box set, I think. I'm pretty sure it's the third box set. It's interesting hearing these stories because they're very American. I mean, of course, you know, both Eric Roberts and Chase Masterton are both American, but the whole flavor of the box set is American. It's much more like a Star Trek in some ways than a Doctor Who. And so it really does take me a bit of a while to get my head around. Now, both Eric Roberts and Chase Masterton are both recorded by Jason Hay Gallery in the States. The rest of the cast is all recorded back in England. In America, it's recorded by Jason Hay Gallery. In England, it's Barnaby Kay has taken over. It must be very difficult to have your two leads not actually with you. I think Barnaby Kay got to act a lot of parts because of it. I think he was doing a lot of the reading in. But it's fascinating in terms of how this story progresses. As I said, the feel isn't like a Master story in some ways. It's a very lousy, rotten Master in terms of there's always a bit of warmth that Jacoby has and Missy has. Eric Roberts hasn't got that warmth at all. And it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting. In one level, he plays everything on one note. And I was actually listening all the way through Eric Robertson's performance, and he hardly varies anything. And I think it actually works for the master, but everything is the same pitch. Like, nothing changes in terms of pitching. So you may or may not like this. It's worth listening to because it's interesting, but it's not fantastic. So I'm not recommending it because you must go out and buy this. But if you're curious to hear a continuation of The Master, what they've done with him, and also they bring Paul McGann in as well, because it's actually an Axon story. And so the Axons, you know, have a body copy of the Doctor, of course, and so Paul McGann gets to play a role as an Axon and get to be a baddie. It's pretty fascinating. It's interesting. It's not the best thing that you're ever going to hear, but it really is an intriguing piece and worth having listened to, I think. Excellent. So what about you, Duane? What have you been listening to?
I have been listening to an older release from Big Finish, released in 2016, something from the classics range and something I hadn't heard up to this point, and that is Mark Gatiss starring as Dracula, which is a fascinating story, and it's adapted by Jonathan Barnes, who is an interesting writer because he does a lot of the classic Big Finish adaptations. And just like Frankenstein, where they have done it very close to the book, they've done it, and the books of those in those styles were done like lots of letters to each other. Dracula was the same. So it's done in a very similar way as well. And Mark Gatiss as Dracula is different, which is always interesting. It's quite frightening. I know he did a version of it for TV just a few years ago, which I haven't seen, but that intrigues me as well, because I've heard that it's quite different, quite a different take on the books, which may be something similar to what Stephen Moffat did with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, modernised it, I don't know. As I said, I haven't seen it, but this one sticks really closely to the book. You might hear some familiar voices. Katie Manning has a part in it. Elizabeth Morton, Peter Davison's wife, has a part in it as well. And it's very, very creepy in parts. But yeah, Mark Gatiss, he does it well. He likes his horror. If you've ever enjoyed The League of Gentlemen, you know that those boys like their horror genre, and so Mark Gatiss really steps into that with Dracula. So that's what I've been listening to, and I've been enjoying it.
Yep. I saw directed by Scott Hancock, and he really loves his horror and fear as well. So I was actually listening to something else by Scott Hancock, written and directed by him this week. I was listening to the last Dorian Gray.
For the
10th anniversary. So yeah, I listened to that. That was good too. I wrote a review for that. So I sent it off to the Big Fish podcast. So we'll see whether it gets done this week or not.
I'll have to listen to that one then, Philip.
Oh, I had a letter read last week in the email section.
Did you?
Yeah, about the Wendy Pedbury tour.
Oh, very good. Very good.
And when Wendy I just got a message from Wendy before we came on saying she's finally back home after a month away. What an amazing time she had. And, good for her. She's home and said it's cold and she wants to come back.
Yeah, very good. Where I am, I'm in a very remote part of West Australia at the moment. If anyone knows the Ningaloo Coast, that's where I am speaking to you from right now, at a place called Windara Bandy out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. And I was just looking at the temperature today. It was 32 degrees and I'm getting those kind of temperatures every single day. I tell you, I was thinking today, I'm not looking forward to going back to Tasmania, particularly going back in July.
No.
Which the temperature is going to be quite a contrast to here. So, yeah, I'm trying to make the most of it while I'm here.
I am. A little other bit of news for me was I had a few of my fingers fall down today, which I thought that's a bit unusual. The whole they tumbled. And I found out we had an earthquake, a mini earthquake, about 3 o'clock.
Oh, wow.
Oh, no, that's why they fell down.
Whereabouts was that?
I'm not quite sure where the epicenter was.
Off the coast
somewhere? No, I'm not 100% sure. It was just in the Winston Hills page, the number of people talking about the fact that they felt this minor tremor. So I haven't had a chance to go look it up because I came on with you. But then I went, that explains why my fingers fell down. It's not doing any damage. I just got to pick up all my fingers again. That's why I'm lying down. A bit sad for himself, that Cyberman.
Well, you take care of those little babies, won't you?
I will do.
All right. Lovely being your presence again, Philip. Thanks for joining me.
You too, Dwayne. Have a good week.
Catch you later, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
This has been the Sirens of Audio episode 190, Remembrance, Countermeasures and Beyond, with our guests Karen Gledhill and your hosts Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Theme music by Joe Kramer. More about us at sirensofaudio.com. Comment below to give us your feedback or contact us by email at sirensofaudio@gmail.com or via any one of our socials using the handle @audiosirens. Thanks for listening, audiophiles. We'll hear you next time.